Chapter 4. I think it was Charlotte Bronte who once said that it is a truth universally acknowledged that a pair of single men in a club must be in want of feminine company, so I was far from surprised when a fine example of the feminine form slipped into the spare seat at our table. She was a modern American girl, which meant that her hair and dress were scandalously short and her manner forward. She had a handsome profile and slender neck and seemed familiar, but I couldn't place her, although she certainly seemed to know me. "Why, Gussie," she cooed, "are you going to introduce me to your handsome friend?" That put me in a quandary, since I couldn't introduce the young lady, as I had no recollection of her name. On the other hand, these modern girls are not beyond pretending to familiarity in order to oil their way into one's company. So I bit the bullet and decided to fall back on my upbringing. "I'm afraid you have me at a disadvantage," I said stiffly.
"Perhaps I do," she said with a sly smile. "You may call me Coco." She looked over at Nightingale. "And now you may introduce me."
Nightingale saved me the job by extending a hand.
"Thomas Nightingale,"
he said, and they shook in the rather masculine fashion modern girls seem to prefer.
"Coco," she said again, but the bell of memory remained resolutely unrung. "Pleased to meet you, Tommy. Have you been in New York long?"
"I arrived just this morning,"
he said.
"My, you do work fast, don't you, Tommy?"
She affixed a gasper to the end of a long black holder and pointed it at Nightingale.
"Got a light?"
Nightingale hesitated a moment before drawing a matchbook from his pocket and, with a flourish, lighting a match one-handed. I thought it was damned impressive myself. I've always burnt my fingers when I've attempted that particular trick, but Coco seemed less than impressed, perhaps even disappointed. Still, I don't claim to understand the minds of these modern women.
"What do you think of the band?"
she asked Nightingale. I'd given Nightingale a surreptitious glance during the band's first set. His face had been fixed in a perfectly pleasant expression throughout the first number, and stayed that way even when the band was joined by some very comely coloured showgirls with scandalously short skirts and exposed navels. The funny thing is that, had I encountered this band in London, I would have thought them very fine indeed. But for all their skill, the musicians stuck to the sort of foxtrot-fixated dance music that one might hear on the wireless. Lucy certainly wouldn't have approved, and I was really quite glad he hadn't been able to attend. He can become quite scathing when he doesn't think the jazz is up to scratch.
"They seem perfectly fine," said Nightingale.
"They're just the warm-up," said Coco. "The real stuff is in the next set. Wanna dance?"
To my surprise, Nightingale said he would. As the next set commenced, he stood to take Coco's arm. She leaned over and winked at me.
"There's a new dance," she said. "You'll like this one. It's called the Black Bottom."
And then, with a gay laugh, off she went, leaving me none the wiser. Nightingale danced just the way I'd expected him to, with grace and precision, but with no sense that he was letting go or losing himself in the music. Lucy dances in his own little world, with frequent stops to listen to the band and make, so he tells me, mental notes. He once asked me what I thought of while I was dancing, and I had to confess that I thought of nothing at all, once I'd learnt the steps, that is. Coco took pity on me, and swapping out Nightingale taught me the Black Bottom, which really wasn't as risque as the name implies. I turn a good leg on the dance floor and soon picked it up, earning, I believe, the respect of Coco, who returned us to our table and insisted on ordering champagne at a ruinous price. This was to be expected, and so I signed the chit without demur as the dance floor was cleared, the showgirls returned, and a lady of operatic proportions gave a rendition of I've Found a New Baby in a style of which Ethel Waters would have been proud. On the second chorus, the singer swept in amongst the tables and paused at ours to exchange conspiratorial looks with Coco before gliding on. I turned to ask her whether she knew the singer, but was distracted by the look on Nightingale's face. He was intent on the band, where a young man, coloured like all the performers, had stood to break into a trumpet solo.
"Do you know him?"
Nightingale asked me, but I'd never heard him before. Whoever he was good. But when I listened carefully, I could sense the same thing Nightingale could. Intertwined through his melody was a silent counterpoint, a breezy whisper amongst the treetops, the smell of pine and lazy buzz of a bumblebee. I could almost taste the honey.
"Johnny Black," said Coco, "new talent up from Memphis."
"Interesting,"
said Nightingale.
"You seem well informed. Do you think Mr. Baker is in the club tonight?"
"I saw him when I came in," said Coco.
Nightingale declared that, in that case, he would go and pay his respects, and stood.
"Why don't you stay here and keep Coco entertained?"
he said, which I took to mean, keep an eye on the trumpeter while he was away. I was all for this role, not being one for confrontations, particularly with shady nightclub owners, and while the band was not as modern as I might have liked, unlike Lucy, I rarely feel the need to absent myself from poor music. I believe he feels that listening to inferior jazz may contaminate his higher music sensibility. It comes as a shock to many to find that aficionados of modern music can be quite as snooty as any habitué of the Royal Opera House. More so, come to think of some of the rummy types one finds around Covent Garden. After Nightingale had gone, Coco and I sipped the ruinously expensive champagne and watched the show, which was livened up considerably by a pair of male tap dancers who so astonished with their fluid dexterity that it was almost a relief when the chorus girls joined them and they had to slow down so the ladies could keep up.
"Your friend Tommy," said Coco at the end of the set, "is he famous, rich, one of those lords?"
"Why do you ask?" I asked, which made her laugh.
"Because you treat him like he is," she said.
"He was above me at school," I said.
"Was it a swell school?"
"Was yours?"
"Mine could have been better," she said. "But they say you learn all the important lessons outside of school."
"That's certainly true of Oxford," I said, for I had many happy memories of learning to drink while balancing on the back of a chair, and how to kiss au français and other secret skills. I am not the tallest beanstalk in the kingdom, but by then I had realized that there was something decidedly rummy about Coco. She seemed ill at ease, as if waiting for somebody else, and when we finished the champagne, she did not chivy me to immediately buy another bottle. Good sport that I am. I was about to suggest another bottle myself when Nightingale reappeared at the table and said it was time to leave. I had just enough time to bid adieu to Miss Coco before having to race after Nightingale, who was briskly striding out of the club. "Are we following someone?" I asked when I caught up with him on the street.
"Not yet,"
said Nightingale. Despite what you might see in the cinema, New York is remarkably free of alleys. But there was a mews behind the nightclub, where the stage door let out amidst oversized American dustbins and piles of rubbish from the kitchens. A couple of rats squeaked and scampered away as Nightingale drew me into the shadows. Even with the persistent rain, I might have thought the situation had romantic possibilities if I wasn't so sure that we were, in fact, waiting for someone else.
"I ascertained that Mr. Black would be finishing his set by 11,"
said Nightingale.
"When following a target, it's always better to be slightly ahead of them at the start. Otherwise, by the time we'd left our seats and come back here, he could have been long gone."
I understood the logic, but I was still mourning that second bottle of champagne. I was about to give expression to my sense of loss when Nightingale whispered,
"Quiet,"
in my ear and pointed at the mouth of the mews. A small, skinny boy, no more than 11, dressed in long trousers, puttees, a ragged raincoat, and a flat cap, crept in from the street and leant up against the wall. When he turned to look towards the stage door, I could see he was coloured. He sighed and hunched his shoulders against the rain, and I didn't need Nightingale to warn me that he too had been set to watch the back of the club. I felt, rather than heard, Nightingale whisper a long, complicated spell and experienced a dashed strange sensation as if the air were thickening around me. I glanced to the left and right and saw that the shadows which concealed us had grown thicker and darker. This was advanced magic indeed, and I was reminded that while anyone can use a violin as a club, not everyone can make it sing. We waited what seemed half the night before the door banged open, and we watched as half a dozen musicians emerged from the stage door, chatting, laughing, and lighting up gaspers. Mr. Black wasn't amongst them, and I was about to step out of our personal shadow when he stuck his head out of the door and looked suspiciously both ways. He then slipped out and cautiously walked to the end of the mews. When I went to follow, Nightingale put his hand on my arm to restrain me. The young boy in the flat cap waited until Mr. Black had passed by before pushing off the wall and following. Only then did Nightingale and I follow suit. I don't know if you've ever attended Royal Henley, particularly when it rains, but if you have experienced the well-dressed crowds, the bustle and the sheer energy, then I'm here to tell you that Lennox Avenue was just as bustling, only long, straight, and with the added risk of being run over by a trolley bus. And although the risk of drowning is much less, it's just as difficult to follow someone through the heaving mass, especially when they know where they're going and you don't. And you don't want them to know you're following them.
Where do you think he's going?
Asked Nightingale, as he slid gracefully through the crowd. I haven't a clue, I said, and swerved to avoid a collision with the umbrella of a portly lady of middle years in a large but unfashionable hat. I don't suppose we might just ask him? Fortunately for us, the young boy in the flat cap proved a dogged pursuer, and so, by making sure we kept either him or Mr. Jonathan Black in sight, we successfully tracked our quarry to a basement speakeasy on 135th. A pair of large coloured gentlemen, serving as what the Americans call bouncers, eyed us with an air of bemusement as we approached the door. Once inside, it was quickly apparent as to why. Everybody in the establishment, from the barman to the clientele to the small band on the stage, were Negroes. This was a club where white men were prohibited. It is one of the rummy aspects of New York life that many places, clubs, restaurants, and even shops, operate on what they call Jim Crow principles, although as to who Mr. Crow was, neither Beauregard nor Lucy, who between them know all there is to know about everything in America, would provide illumination. Such establishments do not admit coloured people, regardless of whether they are the right sort or not, or even if, like the Alexandra, the performers and staff are coloured. Some Negro club owners reciprocate and refuse to allow in white customers. When I asked Lucy why, he answered that sometimes black folks needed to escape to somewhere where they didn't have to worry about the white man. When I inquired further whether he felt he needed to escape me too, he said that yes, on occasion he did. I have to say that I found that dashed rummy, but Lucy said I shouldn't take it personally. It was just one of those things. I found a nice, unobtrusive booth at the side, but try as I might, I could not get a waitress to notice me. After a while, a slim coloured man, in quite the best suit I'd seen in New York so far, slipped in to join us. He had a boxer's face, although I did not think for a minute he'd acquired his lumps and scars in the ring. It was, as the song might say, a face that had seen trouble. When he smiled, there were gold teeth.
"Gentlemen,"
he said,
"why are you here?" "My name is Thomas Nightingale, and I'm a talent scout for a London music publisher,"
said Nightingale.
"Gussie here said your band was reputed to be top-notch, so I was hoping to listen in."
The man nodded thoughtfully and then turned to me.
"Hey, I've seen you around,"
he said.
"You're a friend of Lucian's. Do you vouch for this man here?"
"Absolutely," I said. "They're always looking for new faces in the West End. That's the West End of London, which is where the shows, The man held up a hand to cut me off.
I visited London, Mr. Gussie, he said. I'm aware of Theatreland.
He clicked his fingers and a pair of cocktails materialized in front of us.
You may stay to the end of the set,
he said, and stood up.
And the drinks are on the house. Enjoy the show.
Which I did. And, more remarkably, so did Nightingale. This band were the proper stuff, and when Jonathan Black played his solo, the notes cascaded and entwined like the wind blowing through musical leaves. A wind that then gathered them in a taut little tornado and swirled them to a swiftly spinning conclusion. Nightingale sat with his eyes wide but seeing nothing, and I smiled to myself and thought, Gussie, old boy, another convert to the cause. Even the cocktail, which was pure Harlem gin-flavoured with limes and sugar, failed to lower the mood, although Nightingale wisely left his untouched. He sighed when the set ended.
I think I am beginning to see the attraction of this music,
he said.
Did you notice the Concordia Arcana behind Mr. Black's solo?
Rather, I said. You never said whether Mr. Baker was helpful or not.
So I didn't,
said Nightingale.
How remiss of me. It was quite an interesting conversation. But I think we should seek out our elusive trumpeter before our host becomes restive and throws us out.
I glanced over to where the well-dressed bruiser stood to one side of the stage, no doubt surveying his domain. He caught my eye and frowned. I do have a burning question for him, however, I said. The frown deepened as we approached. Sir, I wonder if you might satisfy my curiosity in one matter, I asked. The man raised a dangerous eyebrow.
Just the one question?
He asked. You must tell me who your tailor is. When the chap had stopped laughing, he wrote the name and address on a small notepad and handed it over. I had just enough time to thank him politely before Nightingale got a firm grip on my elbow and guided me into the kitchens.
Quick, he said. Our quarry is flushed.
What makes you think he's going out the back?
Because we're not the only ones on his trail.
We reached the bottom of a dim, narrow staircase in time to see Mr. Black pause at the top, to shrug into his raincoat and push his way out. Up the steps we trotted, with Nightingale in the lead, and out into the rain. There was another of those unpleasantly rubbish-strewn areas that always lurk behind even the best locales, and a passageway through the buildings opposite that led off to the street. Mr. Black saw us and turned to leg it up the passageway, but before we could give chase, he came running back towards us. Behind him, a dashed unpleasant but musical voice called, Johnny!
Johnny, why are you making this hard for us?
Mr. Black swung at Nightingale with his trumpet case, but Nightingale avoided the blow easily and caught Mr. Black's arm as casually as if they were dancing. Down the passageway, I could see pale faces over cheap suits walking purposefully towards us.
Who are your friends, Johnny?
Said the leader.
Gussie,
said Nightingale,
if you don't mind.
I did mind, because had I wanted to spend my time roughhousing with riffraff, ne'er-do-wells and belligerent fay, I would have put myself forward to become a prefect, or whatever it is the likes of Nightingale are calling themselves these days. Nonetheless, never let it be said that an alumni of Casterbrook was ever backwards about rallying round when push comes to shove, or when impello comes to propellare. Those are spells, I might add. Mindful that I didn't relish the thought of the thuggish gentleman seeking retribution at a later date, I threw a full gay in their face to dazzle them and prevent them getting a good look at yours truly. Then, while they staggered around clutching their eyes and shouting, I knocked them down with an impella palma. 1, 2, 3, and then stuck them to the ground with the treacle foot. Of course, they wouldn't stay down long, but certainly long enough for us to leg it back down the stairs and into the club.
Very nice,
said Nightingale, as I used the wood variant of Ayanua Dairesco to stick the back door closed.
Who are you?
Asked Mr. Black, as we made our way to the street, by the kitchens, the pantry, and, accompanied by screams of outrage, the ladies' changing room. Eventually, we were standing in the rain on 135th Street, trying to restrain our trumpeter while not being too obvious about it.
"We mean you no harm," said Nightingale, "but we need to ask you some questions."
"Are you cops?" he asked.
"No,"
said Nightingale.
"We're instrument makers."
Chapter 5. As I believe I have mentioned previously, thanks to the efforts of the mysterious Mr. Crow, there are few places coloured and white patrons can gather together in public without drawing attention, particularly when musically voiced but unspecified thugs are on your trail. So I suppose it was inevitable that we would end up at Lucy's Diggings on Sugar Hill, where the well-heeled denizens of Harlem roosted. He rented a basement flat of what the Americans call a townhouse, the upper floors of which were occupied by a family of undertakers. Next door, Lucy has informed me, lives a celebrated physician who specializes in maternity care. Thus, as I believe I have mentioned before, from birth to death, a man may never need to set foot outside Harlem.
"When a man is tired of Harlem," quoth Lucy, "he is tired of life."
Lucy opened the door, dressed in an exquisite red silk dressing gown with gold embroidery that I admired tremendously, and not solely because I had purchased it for him as a Christmas present and owned a matching garment in green. Unfortunately, all clothes, be they ever so carefully tailored or pressed, immediately rumpled once Lucy has donned them. I've seen it with my own eyes, and the process is essentially instantaneous. I once turned to Beauregard for advice, but all he could offer was that it was sometimes the gentleman's lot to bear such vicissitudes with fortitude. Fortunately, the dictionary I keep in my desk for such moments had a definition for vicissitude. Lucy certainly looked as if the vicissitudes of life were pressing heavily when he opened the door to find the three of us on his doorstep. Since he did not keep a valet himself, it fell to me to arrange refreshments in the drawing room, while Lucy withdrew to don one of his disreputable tweed suits. Lucy keeps a couple of bottles of my Canadian whiskey on hand for visitors, or when we entertain select friends. I didn't spare the spirits as I poured the drinks, since we were all in need of a restorative. Lucy knew Mr. Black by sight, and Mr. Black knew Lucy by reputation. All the good musicians of New York knew about Mr. Lucian Gibbs and his incisive reviews in The Crisis and The Messenger. When I pointed out that many musicians lived in fear of his disapprobation, Lucy smiled, somewhat smugly, and said that they only lived in fear if they feared the truth. It's a rummy thing, but I could have sworn that what Mr. Black actually feared was his trumpet. There was something odd about the way he gingerly removed it from its case and placed it on an occasional table for our inspection. There's always been something appealingly compact and masculine about the trumpet, if an instrument can be said to have an essence, that is. But this one certainly had an essence, and indeed felt dangerously alive. I could believe that it thought its own thoughts, made up of scales and tones and harmonies. At school we were taught to be wary of such things. They start small, but they can grow. Nightingale, with feigned casualness, reached out a hand to touch the bell and run a finger down the pipe. He looked at me and frowned, and then turned to Mr. Black.
"Tell me, Mr. Black," he said, "how this instrument came into your possession."
"I was hired for an engagement on Long Island," said Mr. Black.
"Who hired you?"
"Old Fat Sam Milovich, who manages the Lenox Avenue Swing Band," said Mr. Black. "They were short a trumpet for a private engagement, a party up at some grand place past Manhasset, and I was still building a reputation at the time."
Mr. Black described the location of the engagement as the kind of place I always imagined the King of England owning, and had its own ballroom, even bigger than the Roxy.
The crowd was nothing but Nordics, so the dancing wasn't much, although some of the white girls were pretty, said Mr. Black, who'd been warned not to get carried away during his solo. As the band leader had said, these folks won't appreciate your style, boy, so you might as well save it for them that does.
Still, Mr. Black hadn't been able to resist slipping some hot licks into the turnaround of Don't Bring Lulu.
You know how it is, said Mr. Black. If you got it, you've got to let it out.
His trumpet apparently agreed, because now it gave a queer sort of harmonic buzz at the words, let it out. Mr. Black visibly edged further away from the instrument. During their break at this engagement, some of the musicians had stepped outside for gaspers and to jazz some muggle, Mr. Black amongst them, although he assured us, and Lucy in particular, that he never did reefer when he was playing.
Too much respect for the music, he said. Also, I don't like the smell.
Which is why he had moved away a little, to a more isolated spot around the corner of the mansion, when something made him look up.
It was strange, he said. It wasn't a noise or a light. It was more like a feeling, like I'd heard my name called by someone who wasn't there. So I looked up and saw this face peering out at me from one of the high windows. Pale and sad, is all he could manage as a description. Not that I had much time to look, said Mr. Black, because that's when she dropped the trumpet case on him.
Caught it just in time, he said. Damn near knocked me down.
When he looked up again, the face was gone, and Mr. Black cheesed the case in the staff restroom while they completed the next set. He didn't dare open it until he was back in his diggings and tried it out.
It was already morning by then, he said, so I went out on the fire escape and gave it a whirl. I knew it was special from the first blows, so smooth like silk. Know what I'm saying?
But, said Nightingale,
you can get tired of smooth, can't you? Said Mr. Black,
and he stepped further back from his trumpet.
Real music has those rough edges. Smooth is for liars, fake loos, and preachers, ain't it? It's beautiful, but I don't trust the sound coming out of it anymore.
Why do you keep the bally thing, then? I asked.
I pawned my old trumpet, he said. Now I'm stuck with this one.
He looked at Nightingale.
It's cursed, ain't it? That's the feeling I get from it, like it's got some purpose other than music.
I rather believe it is, said Nightingale. How much would it cost to redeem your old trumpet?
My earlobe began to itch as I foresaw, clearly, as it happened, that my ear was about to be severely bitten. In the end, I forked out the green. American money is all green for some reason. But Lucy had to chip in to make up the amount. Enough, in my opinion, for a brand new trumpet, and then some.
And once you have recovered your old trumpet, I suggest you look for employment in a different city, at least for a year or two,
said Nightingale. He looked over at Lucy.
Suggestions, Lucian?
In Chicago, said Lucy. I hear good things about Chicago.
There you go, said Nightingale. I'm sure we can arrange a ticket.
Not without a trip to the Bally Bank first, I thought. Nightingale packed the cursed trumpet back in its case, being careful, I noticed, to touch the instrument as little as possible.
Do you remember who the owner was of the house on Long Island?
He asked. Mr. Black didn't, but he was sure Fat Sam would know, since he arranged the engagement. And once we have the address, what then? I asked. Are we to march up to their door and inquire about enchanted instruments?
You know, Gussie, old bean, said Nightingale. We might just try that.
Mr. Black's rented diggings were in a tenement building on 134th Street, in the part of Harlem they called the Valley. Lucy says that here the inhabitants are charged twice the price for half the space, because if they move in anywhere else, the local Nordics will set fire to their front door. We were visiting in the rain, because Nightingale believed that the thugs I'd stuck to the pavement were bound to have made it their next stop. 2-1, they've called it a night, I said.
I'll take those odds,
said Nightingale. And for a moment it looked like I might be £10 up. Except we spotted the skinny coloured boy who'd been watching the alley behind the Alexandra, hunched in a nearby doorway. He looked like a drowned mouse that had been left guarding the empty cheese store while his friends have all scurried off for an evening of port and Stilton, and he did not look happy at all. Doubtless his disposition was not improved when he looked up to find me and Nightingale striding purposefully towards him, and dampened even further as, when he tried to run, he found his shoes stuck to the ground.
"Good evening,"
said Nightingale.
"Were you, by any chance, keeping a lookout for Mr. Jonathan Black?"
"Are you cops?" asked the boy.
"No,"
said Nightingale.
"We're from the Lost and Found."
Naturally, it took some time to persuade the boy that we meant him no harm, but, aided by the liberal application of dollar bills, which, I might add, came out of my reserve supply, we were able to elicit the information that he was indeed, yes, sir, keeping an eye out for that trumpet-playing man. Nightingale asked what procedure the poor drowned boy was to follow in the event of Mr. Black being foolish enough to show his face. The boy said that he was to report his presence to the white men who'd paid him to watch, and were even now cheerfully ensconced, warm and dry, in a nearby bar.
"If you would go and fetch them," said Nightingale, "and then I believe it might be wise to retire for the night."
It took the thugs less than 5 minutes to draw up in 2 automobiles, during which time the rain intensified. Some of the men alighted and advanced on us, no doubt with a view to laying hands on our persons, but we forestalled them by strolling nonchalantly over to the closest flivver, where their leader had sensibly decided to stay out of the rain. Nobody had drawn any weapons yet, which was a relief to me and good news for them. Nightingale held up the trumpet case to show the leader.
"You wouldn't be looking for this, would you?"
When I was at Oxford, I thought nothing of rising at dawn, avoiding lectures the livelong day, and then commencing a late supper with pals and a night of revelry. Occasionally, these nocturnal frolics would end with an early morning jaunt upon the ices in a borrowed punt. I believe it was a sign of my growing maturity that I no longer relished the prospect of messing about in boats, especially in such disreputable company. Not that there was anything disreputable about the 60-foot motor yacht that awaited us over at the docks. In fact, once we, that is, Nightingale, the top thug, and I, were seated comfortably in the finely appointed lounge compartment, and the yacht cast off, we were offered coffee and pastries. The top thug was an ugly customer, albeit a well-dressed one, the same blighter with the musical voice that I'd knocked down at the back of the club. His head was shaved at the sides, and his thinning, light brown hair had been slicked back above a pair of cold blue eyes, a strong nose, and a square jaw, which he had a tendency to grind. We slid through the dark waters with the lights of the wharves gliding past. "So, is this your boat?" I asked brightly. Now, many will tell you that I have a tendency to chatter when nervous, and, mindful of this, I did try to maintain the same air of stoic taciturnity as Nightingale throughout the 2 hours or so we were afloat, but it's bally difficult to keep your nerves stuck on a boat, in the dark, with a brace of Brunos and heading who knew where. Long Island, it transpired. A huge house, larger than Buck House, but not as squared off, and blazing with light and music. As we moored at the private dock, it was obvious that a party was underway, or rather had reached that stage when half the guests have left or collapsed, and the remainder aimlessly wander in search of a reason to stay awake. We walked past at least one couple en déshabillé, in the bushes, as we were led up a gravel path towards the side of the house. Nightingale scrutinised the top windows, no doubt thinking of the pale face and the carelessly thrown trumpet case. We were led in through a side door and through the kitchens, up a flight of uncarpeted wooden stairs, out of a disguised doorway into a vast office with a desk you could play ping-pong on. The top thug showed us to a pair of leather-bound pumpkin-orange chairs facing the desk, and leaving us under the watchful gaze of two of his underlings, left the room. "I say," I started, but Nightingale waved me to silence. Behind the desk was a tall window through which we could see the formal gardens leading down to the private pier, and beyond that, the black waters of the bay. Which bay, precisely, I'm not sure. I keep meaning to look it up on a map, but for some reason I've never got around to doing so. But it was definitely a bay, of which Long Island has a great many. Somewhere outside, a band was not so much winding up as going down with the ship, and there were occasional shrieks and gales of laughter tinged with desperation. I judged it must have been an excellent night out, and wished I hadn't been otherwise engaged. There was no mistaking the man the top thug returned with as anything less than the big cheese, the lord of the manor and the boss of bosses. A tall, languid man of late middle years, with a long neck upon which a round head bobbed like a globe lamp with a face painted on it. Judging from the blotchy cheeks and the bleary gaze he threw at us when he entered, he had been an enthusiastic participant in the night's revelries. His evening suit, however dishevelled, was unmistakably from Henry Poole of Savile Row. I followed Nightingale's lead and stood politely when he entered. He waved us back down and sat in the leather chair that matched the desk in size and grandeur. A coloured servant entered with a jug of coffee, but only, I noticed, a single cup. We watched as he drank the first cup, and then waited some more as the servant poured a second before being sent out of the room. The top thug remained.
"Do you know who I am?"
asked the man behind the desk.
"I'm afraid you have the advantage of me,"
said Nightingale.
"But my name is Thomas Beresford, and this is my associate, Bertram Wilberforce. We are musicologists from the Royal College of Music in London."
Nightingale fished a card from his jacket pocket and held it up. After a pregnant pause, the top thug came forward to retrieve the card and convey it to his boss, who squinted at it and then tossed it down on the green baize desk blotter.
"My name is Charles Yeager," he said. "This is my associate, Mr. Clydesdale. What brings you to my house?"
Nightingale lifted the trumpet case and placed it on the desk. He opened it and rotated it to display the contents to Mr. Yeager.
"I believe you are looking to recover this item,"
he said. Mr. Yeager was not surprised, which in turn was not surprising, since we'd already discussed the matter with Mr. Clydesdale, and no doubt he'd briefed his employer. His eyes flicked from the case to Nightingale and then to me. For all the traces of dissipation on his face, Mr. Yeager's eyes were a hard, penetrating blue, and I was relieved when the gaze passed back to Nightingale.
"And presumably you are looking for a finder's fee?"
he asked.
"No, sir,"
said Nightingale.
"My colleague and I are interested in where such instruments originate. We thought you might be able to shed some light in that direction."
Mr. Yeager smiled thinly and he sat back in his chair.
"I'm afraid I can't really help you there,"
he said, in what would have been a far more affable manner if his eyes hadn't flashed dangerously. Lucy is of the opinion that rich Nordics find it hard to mask their feelings.
"After all," he says, "they live in a world where everything revolves around their every desire, so there's little need for them to keep their base emotions hidden."
He's fond of phrases like that, especially after we'd had dinner with Wallace Thurman, who was a Bolshevik to the core. But in this instance, I'm forced to agree, at least as far as American millionaires are concerned. His face took on a glazed expression that would be familiar to anyone who's ever confronted a small child with a bag full of stolen apples, then became animated again as he thought of a good excuse.
"It was left behind after one of my wife's parties," he said. We never did find out where it came from.
He turned his attention to his henchman.
Mr. Clydesdale, if you would show these gentlemen out and, oh, provide them with some remuneration for their exertions.
To my great surprise, Nightingale, the lion of the rugby pitch, allowed himself to be meekly shown out of the same tradesman's door we'd entered through, although he did have the cheek to pocket the money proffered with ill grace by Mr. Clydesdale. Outside, the sky ahead was already a silver grey, as we were then escorted down a long gravel drive, past a mock Tudor gatehouse, and through a decorative but nonetheless tall and imposing gate, which was firmly clanged shut behind us. I say, Thomas, I don't think that man was telling the truth.
I believe you may be right,
said Nightingale. He looked around.
Do you have any idea where we are?
There was a wide gravelled road running perpendicular to the great house and its grounds. Judging by the lightening of the sky, it ran north-south. Somewhere on the north side of Long Island, I said. If we walk south, I believe we should encounter the railway back to the city.
Good,
said Nightingale.
Because I think I would like another word with the Reverend Edwards.
We'd barely left the gate behind when we chanced upon a Dodge automobile that had clearly come off the lane and put its front wheel in a ditch. Being the good Samaritans that we were, we trotted forward to see if we could be of assistance, or if no one was there to assist, we might borrow their vehicle for a ride back to town. When I stepped onto the running board and looked in the back, I was startled to find a girl in a white fox fur wrap curled up asleep in the back seat. When I asked whether she was all right, she uncurled and stretched like a cat. It was then I saw that it was none other than Coco, the flapper from the Alexandra, wearing a dress that was even shorter and a great deal more shimmery with beads and whatnot. I think it was a very dark blue or black, but much to Madame Zarzar's later annoyance, I couldn't say. Who is Madame Zarzar? We shall come to him, or more precisely one of his creations, later. She had a smear of red lipstick across her left cheek and a dark patch on her forehead. Her Marcel wave had suffered overnight so that a frizzy patch had sprung up at the top, like a neglected geranium. I can sympathise, because I remember my mater's hair frequently did the same on hot summer days. And as my dear old maternal origin would do in those circumstances, Coco seized a cloche hat from somewhere about her person and jammed it on her head. And once her coiffure was suitably hidden, she turned her attention on us. "Good gracious!" she said, once both eyes had focused. "If it isn't the English boys, what are you doing out here in the sticks?"
"I was about to ask much the same thing,"
said Nightingale. Coco idly reached down the front of her dress and tugged at whatever it is modern girls wear underneath to make themselves fashionably flat-chested. "I was at a party," she said, and vaguely indicated the direction we ourselves had come from. "Over there. Lots of swells and hooch you wouldn't believe. I meant to glom some bottles on my way out, but I was distracted." "Were you on your own?" I asked, while Nightingale inspected the front of the Dodge where it had gone into the ditch. "No," laughed Coker. "I was with Orson, or was it Digby? Or perhaps his name was Clarence. Clarence Fitzwilliam III. I was out with one of them, but I think they found somebody more entertaining." "I'm sorry to hear that." "Don't be," said Coco. "Whatever his name was, he turned out to be a flat tire." Ironically, the Dodge's own tires were perfectly pressurized. However, it was jammed tight into the ditch. Nightingale called me over, and we made a great show of shouting and heaving to disguise the fact that he pushed it back onto the road with impello. Coco slithered into the driver's seat before we could stop her. "Thanks, boys," she said. "Can I give you a ride into town?" New York, like London, is constantly growing so that in order to reach its heart, one must drive through a series of increasingly frantic building sites. Only this being America, the activity was larger, louder, and more audacious than back home, culminating in the Queensboro Bridge, a span across the East River of such magnificence that it soars over Welfare Island without stopping to let anyone on. Arriving in Manhattan with the sun behind you, flashing off the skyscrapers, you'd have to be a bally stone not to feel a thrill in your heart and wish you could play clarinet, an impulse I entirely blame on George Gershwin, although, word to the wise, do not raise the topic of Rhapsody in Blue with Lucy unless you have a spare 4 or 5 hours to listen to him complain about cultural theft. Coco was an excellent driver and we made good time through the awakening streets until she pulled over outside my building.
What do you plan to do with the car?
Asked Nightingale. Don't you worry your pretty little face about it, said Coco. It'll be Jake. I know a guy. And with that, she zoomed the Dodge off down the street.
She knows a guy called Jake,
said Nightingale.
Or did I misunderstand that?
Jake means good, all right, spiffing, I said. The doorman gave us a knowing look as he opened the door for us.
I see,
said Nightingale.
Did you notice she made a serious mistake?
How so?
She never asked you for your address.
Chapter 6. Now, many of you might be expecting me to regale you with the tale of how, the following morning, I was ripped untimely from my quilted womb, but in truth, the sun was already some distance over the mizzenmast when Beauregard drifted in with the coffee. A pot of coffee, mark you, no doubt anticipating my greater need for revivification. As I sat sipping, Beauregard floated around the room, laying out suitable daywear. Judging by the thick wool and conservative cut of the suit, my valet thought that the afternoon would prove to be unseasonably cold. I asked after Nightingale, and was informed that my guest had risen earlier, gone for a walk, and was currently breakfasting in the dining room. When I joined him, I found him eating pancakes and grits.
I asked for them,
said Nightingale.
When in Rome?
I visited Rome, and I made sure to have kedgeree, eggs, and bacon while I was there. Beauregard, wise to his employer's tastes, served me the same without demur or comment. Once I'd suitably fortified myself with eggs and the strangely brittle bacon that Americans favour, I asked Nightingale what his plans for the rest of the day might be. His eyes flicked after Beauregard, who had returned to the kitchen to do whatever it is he does in there.
I thought we might take a stroll in the park,
he said. The Folly, the slightly shop-worn centre of magic in the British Empire, sits on the south side of a garden square, not too dissimilar in size and character to Washington Square. Although this being New York, the fountain here was bigger, and there was a copy of the Arc de Triomphe sitting opposite the start of Fifth Avenue. It was a blustery, overcast day, but mercifully free of rain, and we stood in the lee of that arch and watched the men swarming up the scaffolding on the building site opposite.
They do like their buildings tall here, said Nightingale.
It's the ground, I said. One of Lucien's friends explained it to me once. The ground is very hard in Manhattan, which makes it easier to build these skyscrapers. We watched a distant figure walk casually along a girder 100 feet in the air.
I wonder what it must be like to be so bold,
he said wistfully. And then his manner changed and became crisp and businesslike.
This Coco woman, she seems to know you.
I thought she was familiar, but I couldn't place her face, I said.
And yet she knew where you lived,
he said.
Have you hosted many salons at your flat?
Truth be told, I had not. The love that dare not speak its name encourages habits of circumspection, and while I've had Lucien and some of our mutual friends for dinner, you would be hard-pressed to regard Shay Augustus as the heart of the city's social whirl. I'm certain she's never visited, I said, but then I wondered if I hadn't seen her talking to Beauregard. Even as I grasped at the memory, it seemed increasingly unlikely, so I dismissed it. I've always found that too much introspection can interfere with the important things in life.
No doubt the mysterious Coco will reappear,
said Nightingale.
Do you believe the trumpet player was telling the truth?
Which trumpet player, Jonathan Black or the Reverend Edwards?
Mr. Black,
said Nightingale,
with his tale of strange pale faces dropping horns from on high.
It would be a peculiar story to make up, I said. Why not just say he redeemed it in a pawn shop or inherited it from a mad old uncle? That would be a cracking mystery, don't you think? A young man, on his uppers, receives a mysterious parcel. He opens it to discover a magical trumpet, and suddenly his fortune is made. But at what price?
Quite, said Nightingale. Mr. Yeager's story that it was left behind after one of his bacchanalia seems all too plausible. And yet...
Quite.
I think Mr. Yeager, Jonathan Black, and Miss Coco may all be in the nature of a red herring,
said Nightingale.
I think it might be time for a stern word with the Reverend Edwards.
I say, what for?
I think he may have been economical with the actualité.
Gosh.
Precisely.
Fancy that, I said. And him a man of God, too. Nightingale contemplated the automobiles passing by.
I say, he said, which one of these cars is a taxi?
That beige one with the check pattern, I said, and hailed it.
It would be easier if there were some consistency,
said Nightingale.
Perhaps they should paint them all a single colour.
I think it would be fair to say that the Reverend David Edwards was less than delighted to find us once again darkening the entrance to his church. The pews were out, and a lectern had been set up on the stage at the end of the room. A dozen or so men and women in blue robes were milling around, while the Reverend Edwards himself pored over sheet music with what I realised must be the choir master. As we advanced upon the stage, we were intercepted by a small, energetic woman with an attractively stern face. That is, her face was attractive despite the steely-eyed look of disapproval beneath lowering brows. Indeed, if you like your women stern and single-minded, then this was definitely the girl for you. "Can I help you, gentlemen?" she asked in a tone that suggested that she doubted both clauses in the sentence.
"I believe you can,"
said Nightingale, and introduced us as musicologists from the Royal Society of Pilgrims.
We wondered if we might have a moment of the Reverend's time.
"You're not getting any more money out of us," she said, but weakening under the onslaught of Nightingale's charm, said she would fetch him as soon as he was available.
"You'll have to forgive my wife," said the Reverend Edwards 5 minutes later. "She fears I am too gullible for my own good. Gentlemen, please."
He gestured us into a pew and took his seat on the one in front. On the stage, the choir started up, only to stop again so the choirmaster could adjust the harmony.
"We wondered if you might clarify a few points about the saxophone,"
said Nightingale, and Edwards immediately grew wary again.
"What do you want to know?"
he said.
"Mark Harper told us that the saxophone had come from his former business partner, a Mr. Stephen Baker. Is he known to you?"
"The dough man," said Edwards. "We all know him. He's the other devil."
"We've spoken to him,"
said Nightingale.
"He claimed to have no knowledge of the instrument."
Edwards scowled, and I presume said something pithy in rebuttal, but I wasn't paying attention because the choir had reached the lively part of their hymn. I can extol the chilly virtues of Bach and Haydn and other Germans, and I've belted out a chorus of All Things Bright and Beautiful myself in the school choir, although I admit I was mostly thinking ungodly thoughts about Cheesewright Jr. and his sports kit at the time. But in my book, even Hark the Herald Angels Sing is as ashes upon the tongue when compared to the way these coloured American choirs can sing. Only the Welsh could give them a run for their money, and only if they cheered up a bit first. I think Nightingale and Edwards must have got into one of those heated arguments that consists of both parties whispering so intently that they resemble a pair of tomcats preparing for some Felix et Felix action. It was, perhaps, because the choir were hitting notes that would have caused a castrato's eyes to water, that I failed to notice that Nightingale had asked me a question until the Reverend Edwards laughed. Sorry, I said. I was listening to the wrong thing, which only made Edwards laugh harder.
Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands, he said.
And right on cue, the choir behind him made such a hallelujah that I almost considered taking up religion again. Fortunately, we children of Albion are made of sterner stuff, so the feeling quickly passed.
Fine, said Edwards. I will tell you the truth, but only because your friend is closer to God than either of us old sinners.
He gave me a long, appraising look.
Even if he don't know it himself.
Lucy says that true musicians always make that mistake, confusing a love of music with spiritual awareness, but I knew better than to make this observation at such a crucial juncture of the conversation.
Like most songs, it starts with the girl, said Edwards, and her name was Morell.
That's a lovely name, I said.
She came to me at a bar in a week before the armistice,
said Edwards.
They knew me there since I'd been visiting every time I got a pass. I used to play for my drinks. By the end of the war, we had a pretty good quartet going. It was liberating being in France. Over there, we were Americans, not Negroes. And she wasn't the first white girl that sidled up to me in that bar looking for some of that southern syncopation.
He looked at Nightingale.
You wouldn't know about that, would you now?
Then he looked at me.
Oh, maybe you do. Anyhow, this frail was different from the rest. She had an air about her, glamour, a style that had nothing to do with money or clothes or how she fixed her hair. I thought she was an angel. I was wrong about that, but that night she was an angel. After that, she was never far away. Hell, she turned up in camp, never mind the sentries on the gate. I'd just find her lying on my cot wearing a wicked smile.
He shook his head.
But there's nothing the army hates more than a bunch of colored soldiers having a good time. So they shipped us home as fast as they could get us on the boat. I thought, there's a good memory to leaven out the bad, to try to slip back into my life. Once you're demobbed, the war can start being like a dream or a nightmare that you had. You learn to stop flinching every time an automobile backfires. You start remembering to say yes, sir, to the white man who would have shit their pants under fire. Then one day, I came home from a session and found her lying in my bed, wearing nothing but that smile.
Did she say how she got there?
Asked Nightingale.
She never spoke, said the Reverend Edwards. Not even back in Europe. If she wanted you to know something, she had ways of letting you know. Otherwise,
he shrugged,
you was in the dark.
So they shared diggings right on 134th Street, and if any of the respectable people had anything to say about it, Edwards wasn't listening to their opinion. He had music and a girl and a place to sleep, and that seemed like paradise to him.
A false paradise, mind you.
He added quickly. Morell had been in Harlem for less than a month when she presented Edwards with the saxophone. Why a saxophone? I asked. You're a trumpeter.
I don't know, he said, but it had the sweetest sound, and I played a bit when I was younger, so I knew what to do. And the Lord knows there were enough young buglers running around town at the time. I stood out with the sax, especially once I started writing.
You wrote your own repertoire?
Asked Nightingale.
Does that surprise you?
Said Edwards.
I learned musical notation back in Memphis. In those days, you learned three things at Sunday school. The Bible, singing, and how to sight read.
Things had gone well enough, but the saxophone had begun to worry him.
Sometimes I weren't too sure who was playing who, he said. There was something ungodly about the whole situation. But when I confronted Morell, I could get no sense out of her. And then...
He trailed off.
And then?
Asked Nightingale.
Things couldn't go on. I couldn't bear to play the sax no more. But to give it up,
I knew I had to give up music, and that was a hard thing to do. When I was with Morel, all I could think of was her, and all she wanted was for me to play. She didn't even care if I got paid or not, just that I played.
Edward shook his head.
It couldn't go on. Something had to give, and then one afternoon I was passing this church and I heard the choir.
The music had drawn him in, and he had met the Reverend Greenway, who was pastor, and found himself confessing the whole sorry story.
It was his idea to put the sax in hock so I wouldn't be tempted, and he gave me a place to stay so I wouldn't have to go back,
said Edwards.
Gave me a brand new calling.
Sir, you never saw Morel again,
said Nightingale. And dashed if there wasn't a frosty note to the way he said it.
Yeah,
said Edwards.
Some kind of warrior, all right. But there had been times when she would look at me and I was terrified. Scared me out of my ever-loving mind every time I stopped playing. I knew I had to make a clean break.
Was it her teeth?
Asked Nightingale. Edwards, who had been getting increasingly chummy, suddenly reared back as if Nightingale had presented him with a live cobra.
Who the fuck are you?
He said, forgetting he was in church.
We're concerned citizens,
said Nightingale in a soothing manner.
These instruments unbalance the world, and our job is to nudge things back to the natural order.
The Reverend Edwards bristled at this.
There's no natural order, he said. Only God's order.
Quite,
said Nightingale.
Was it her teeth?
And her serpent's tongue,
said Edwards.
She was marked. I should have seen it from the start.
All this talk of teeth and tongue had me bamboozled, although, as many of you know, this is a state I have found myself in on a distressingly frequent number of occasions. Still, I had the notion that I should have known what they were talking about. But for the life of me, the old cerebellum was as empty as a biscuit barrel on Boxing Day. Nothing but crumbs.
Do you know what happened to her?
Asked Nightingale.
No,
said Edwards.
It was all I could do to keep myself from running back to her. But the Reverend Greenway and Adele kept me safe. Saw me through it. People talk about the power of prayer, but I have felt it here.
He tapped his chest. I had that horrid feeling that I used to get when I was foolish enough to ask my Uncle Clyde how he was feeling. Without fail, Uncle Clyde, normally a jovial old buffer, would launch into a long description of the regularity of his bowels and the complicated regimen involved in keeping them so. Once he had started, it was no use trying to divert the topic of conversation, no matter what cunning ruse one might employ. An unaccountable number of men fall into this habit. Young and old, rich or poor, and whatever the subject, be it bowels, Bolshevism, or, in this case, the love of Jesus Christ our Saviour, there was nothing for it but to nod at suitable moments and then leg it at the first opportunity. Nightingale, far more ruthless than I, cut the Reverend off in mid-flow with a curt but polite expression of thanks and was off, with me trailing gratefully behind.
I want a word with the wife,
he said, as we reached the foyer.
Did you see where she went?
I had not, but no matter, for it turned out the formidable Mrs. Reverend also wanted a word with us, and was waiting in ambush outside the church. She had adopted an outside hat and black coat of a severe cut, and was attempting an expression of bland politeness that didn't really suit her. Gentlemen, if I might have a word, she said. Nightingale raised his hat.
Mrs. Edwards, I presume,
he said. That's right, she said. And then the veneer of cordiality disappeared. What do you want with my husband? Nightingale suggested that we find somewhere private to converse, but Mrs. Edwards would have none of it, except that we conduct our conversation on the pavement outside the church while the good people of the valley hurried past, although a number did stop to gape. I thought I saw a familiar female face amongst a bunch of coloured girls gossiping on the corner, and for a moment I fancied that it was our erstwhile companion on the road, Coco. When I looked closer, she was clearly a coloured lady, although the resemblance was remarkable. I might have investigated, but Mrs. Edwards' commanding voice dragged my attention back.
"I thank you for not bringing your troubles into my father's church," she said, "and staying away from my husband. He's a good man. He doesn't need the likes of you dragging him back down again."
"We're only interested in his friend Morel," said Nightingale.
"She was no friend of his," said Mrs. Edwards. "It was her that led him to drink and worse."
She lowered her voice until we had to lean in to hear her.
"He was sick when he came to us. I nursed him through the shakes, the ranting, and all that mess until he was free of it. And her. So you'll excuse me if I ask you fine gentlemen to get the hell away from my husband. There are those that owe me favors, and don't think I won't use them up keeping you away."
"Do you know what became of her?"
asked Nightingale.
"What makes you think that I'd know anything about that?"
"Because you're a careful woman, Mrs. Edwards,"
said Nightingale,
"and one who doesn't leave things to chance. So I think you'll have made it your business to know."
Mrs. Edwards cocked her head to one side and let a small, satisfied smile leak a little sunshine into our lives.
"Last I knew, she went and put her hooks into that devil, Mr. Baker," she said.